Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We're also being simulcast on our sister station, WBAI, and WPFW in Washington, D.C., and many other stations. Today, we're going to look at some new superfoods that can help us, especially prevent the flu. I'll also give you the newest information just out in the scientific literature why the flu vaccine is not scientific, is not helpful, actually dangerous. Also today, I'm going to explore a continuation of what was the basis for people dying from massive conditions in the 1817 and 1900s. And it was not the vaccine. It was not the measles. It was not the smallpox and the polio vaccine that eradicated these conditions, yet they've been given all the credit. All during this week, I've been sharing about the abysmal living conditions, the fact that in the Paris that we know of today, it's a clean, beautiful, dynamic city, one of the most important cultural centers of the world, and certainly the best food in the world in one place. And yet, imagine 100 years ago, just 100 years ago, less, in fact, they had over 70,000 septic tanks, cesspools. And yet these were open so that people would just go and dump their human feces in them. And that smell permeated everything. You don't see that in any of the films of the time. You don't see that we didn't have bathrooms. You don't see the putrid food that people ate. You might have a piece of bread on your table for a week, and every night the rats are eating it. Today I'll continue. I'll also be having on someone to discuss this important discovery, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, board-certified nephrologist and an internist, and along with Roma Bastrenik, have written a very important book called Dissolving Illusions. And we'll tell you what the truth is, why these diseases were finally overcame, and she will show the actual scientific literature and the real scholarship that vaccines had nothing to do with it. Also today, commentary from Les Leopold on America's Greatest Shame, Child Poverty Rises and Food Stamps Cut While Billionaires Boom. I'm going to give a little piece on that early in the show and then ask you at our talkback segment later in the show to call in and share your thoughts. Also from Professor Paul Craig Roberts, How America Was Lost. I'll share my own insights. I have a commentary as well. And the world is headed for a high-speed carbon crash, according to Stephen Leahy. And this is from Canada, the latest study on how quickly are we arriving at that point where we can't turn it around on the environment. It's here. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. If you've ever been to Japan, beautiful country with a phenomenal cuisine and people really intimately associated with their food, because it's absolutely traditional for people to eat in season. Also, they take a great deal of time in cultivating their food. They really are experts at organic farming. In fact, the first of the miracle grasses, the barley grass, was harvested in the 1960s and 70s in Japan before anyone paid attention to it in the United States. Millions upon millions of Japanese were eating garlic and garlic extracts before we even became aware of how it can lower blood pressure, help kill viruses, help kill parasites in the intestine. They also were the world's leader in fermenting foods. Now, I'm not sure that they had any knowledge of probiotics, but they certainly had a knowledge of what happens when you want to take something in preventatively. And if you speak with anyone in the traditional, I'm talking about traditional Japanese home, not the modern home that has gone very westernized, they will explain how there's a balance of foods that are eaten, some sweet foods, crunchy foods, cold foods, hot foods, and why. And all throughout that is the pickled food. Well, this is the latest to show you they're way ahead of it, but how you can get this in the United States. Most people are not familiar with pickled turnips, but they should be. Letters in Applied Microbiology, a peer-reviewed journal, says the following from Medical News. Pickled turnips from Japan, a new superfood to prevent flu infection. Quote, scientists have discovered that bacteria found in traditional Japanese pickle can prevent flu. The researchers assessed its immune-boosting powers, specifically the Lactobacillus brevis. Now, there's a lot of different Lactobacillus. Almost all your yogurts, non-dairy and dairy yogurts, have Lactobacillus. But it's the name that follows it that tells you how powerful it is. Well, the brevis, B-R-E-V-I-S, brevis, that is what is used, and that's what makes it so powerful. And they did this research, quote, our research shows that when a particular strain of the Lactobacillus brevis is eaten by mice, it was protective against influenza virus infection, end quote. That's from the actual studies. Now, that's probably one of 300 or 400 different fermented foods that you find, like miso paste. Now, miso paste can come in low sodium or higher sodium. I suggest lower. And it can come very mild, especially this time of year. You want some each day. Let me, in fact, give you a recipe right now for one of the best ways of preventing the flu, colds, and if you're just going into a place where there's a lot of people, you want to just do something to make sure your immune system is strong enough that you'll be less likely to catch something. Now, all of us engage in public events. I was just commenting the other day, in less than 25 hours, I was in three cities, New York to Miami, Miami, then I had a meeting in Atlanta, Atlanta to Charlotte, Charlotte back to New York, all within a short period of time. Do you realize it's an incubation dish? You're in a petri dish when you're in an airplane. And of course, I could determine that a woman right behind me was coughing, not because she had a virus, but because she had an allergy. And I asked her, she said, yeah, I have an allergy. But I still prepare myself. I take vitamin C, and I'll spray some colloidal silver in my nostrils, my throat. Every hour I'm on the plane, I redo this. That protects me. It's not being paranoid, it's being practical. So here's something you can take each day. You can make it once a week, freeze it, and then have it when you feel that you're going to be out, going to a movie, play, wherever, concert. You take some mild miso. I prefer either chickpea miso or a barley miso. Barley is very mild, it's almost like a light yellow. You take 1 tablespoon and you put it in hot, warm but not hot water, certainly not boiling water. Then you dice up 1 cup of shiitake and maitake mushrooms. If you don't have a lot of variety, then use the white butt mushrooms. That's fine as well. Then chop up 1 bulb, that's not a clove, the little clove, no, a bulb of garlic, and you put it in. Then you put some seaweed. You can put wakame, hajiki, nori, dulse, kombu, whatever you choose. Chop it up, put it in. Then 1/4 cup of scallions. And generally, people only eat the end of the scallion. Hey, eat the whole scallion. It doesn't have the crunch, the rest of it, the head of it does, but all the rest of it is terrific as well. Now you put all this in, and you let it steep. And then you can also shave in some, maybe 1 inch of ginger. You shave this in. Now, you let that steep for about a half hour, and then you pour that in. You can make like 1 quart of it, and that's about 1 quart, and you make yourself a bowl, and you have that. You have so much good bacteria, immune-stimulating phytonutrients, antiviral, antibacterial. It tastes delicious. It's a whole meal. And if you can get to a Japanese store, throw in about 1/2 cup of sliced lotus root, which is also good. Now, you can also pour that, as I do, over some brown rice or black rice, or if you have a brown rice pasta, pour it over that. It's a different way of flavoring it, and then you're mixing all these wonderful ingredients together. Very tasty. And so that's one way to help build up your immune system when you're out and about. Tastes good. Everything in there is just good for you. More fermented foods in our diet. For those of you who have any form of neuropathic pain, and we have millions of people who have this in our society, according to Shanghai University of Traditional Medicine, acupuncture relieves the pain. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neuroregeneration Research, Volume 8, and it showed how acupuncture relieves pain. Well, we've known with thousands of studies that acupuncture can relieve lower back pain, headaches, neuropathy. So, not a problem. Acupuncture, safe and effective. I was doing my work last night. I'm preparing for a new lecture. I've been writing, and it's when I sit alone in airports and on planes, I write, and I write longhand, and I write ideas. And I always ask, would someone find this of interest? And am I sharing a perspective or an insight that isn't common, that would give them with that kind of, I like those ooh-ah moments where someone says, ah, and you'll see people when you're lecturing, they're suddenly writing, you know, they got it. They realize that they should keep a hold of that thought and then expand it and see how it applies to them. And in about a week from now, I'll announce when I'm all done and I'm ready to do this lecture. I haven't done a lecture in New York in about a year or more. So anyhow, I'm there and up on the television screen, I'm hearing them talk about how people are eating now and how they're eating such bad foods consistently. And the question is, who are eating these bad foods? Is this everyone in our society? And the answer is no. Here's what it breaks down to. It's about your conditioning, what you were raised to believe in as far as food. For example, my family, where I grew up, my mother insisted, A, that we all eat dinner together. B, that superseded anything else. Now, because I was an athlete, all of us in my family were athletes, she would always put dinner a little later so that if there was practice or a game, that's fine. Then we all sit. Secondly, that we don't rush. If you rushed through your meal, you still had to sit there. You couldn't get up and leave. Third, that you ate what was on your plate. Nothing was to go to waste. My mother came through the Depression, as many of your mothers and fathers came through the Depression, and they did not appreciate waste. Hence, in my family, all the brothers always got the one before them's, clothes. They'd just be altered, which is where I learned how to sew and cut, because I would watch my mother do all this, and I didn't mind. You know, when you're a kid, you don't mind. It's fine. And then any issues that were important were discussed at the meal. Though the serious issues, if there was something important or serious, that had to wait till after the meal, when we went in the living room and sit down. And so it was kind of happy talk. And I thought, how few people do that today? Now, it doesn't mean that we didn't have junk food, because even well-intentioned people who thought they were doing the best, as most people did for their children, would frequently give them foods that today would be considered not healthy. And then all the parents would smoke after a meal, and they'd have coffee, sugar, unfortunately a pie or a cake, and they didn't exercise, and they smoked 2 to 3 packs a day. Then when you hear about all these people dying in their 60s or 50s, you know why. But as best as they could, they give us good food. Now, you look today, most people eat most of their food out. Young people in particular eat their food out. The food they eat is never healthy. And so we have lost 2 generations to this black hole of poor education, unless, and here's the caveat, unless they're better educated. And all the studies show that the better education basis of the parent the more likely they are to instill better eating habits in their children. Now, that's not going to be 100%, but it's certainly the majority. And I've tested this myself time and again. And this is the latest study. It shows, quote, this is from PLOS One, the peer reviewed journal, and it says people with lower levels of education may eat larger amounts of unhealthy, calorie dense food than those with a higher education level. Possibly because they are more physically active? I doubt it. No. I believe it's because of conditioning. And once you start conditioning someone, that it's all right to go out and have a meal out, and then you get used to that salty, crunchy, deep-fried mouthfeel and taste, then everything else you eat that's natural is going to seem boring unless someone knows how to prepare it. That's why, for example, when I'm getting people on a healthy diet, I always include junk food, taste, but made from healthy food. So they think they're eating something that's unhealthy, but indeed they're eating something that's raw and organic and healthy and enzyme-rich. And then when you let them know that that's not a hamburger you just ate, it's not? No. It's a veggie burger. Well, how'd you do that? And then, of course, you show them, give them the tools to empower them. But now look around and ask yourself, how many schools in America teach healthy eating? I mean, really healthy eating. And healthy food, and take people to the farmer's market. I was very impressed when I was down in New Orleans last, and I was filming. There was a school, and it was closed, but one of the people that volunteered there took us into the back of the school, and this is just a regular little school. It wasn't big. It was a junior high and high school, where normally you'd have a back place where students congregate. Here you had a garden, and they had a little hoop greenhouses. Now these are purely passive. It was 40 degrees outside, but inside it was probably about, I'm going to say around 85, 90 degrees, because the sun collects in there, and you have bales of hay, and it absorbs in, and then all these sprouts were growing, and they had all forms of vegetables growing. This past February. And from there, we drove about a mile away to a farmer's market. And there, the students and the teachers were selling to the community organic, local-grown produce, and then sharing the profits between them. The students got half, and the teachers got half. The teachers that volunteered for the program, the students that volunteered for the program, the ones that shared it, as it should be. And it was really cool, because when I was asking questions about, now, what's in broccoli? Why'd you grow broccoli? And why did you grow kohlrabi? And how do you make kohlrabi? They were extraordinarily educated. They knew not only what they were growing, how to grow it, what it did in the body, but what made it unique. And I thought, wow, wouldn't this be great if this was in every junior high, high school, kindergarten, graduate school in the country? I wish that every college in the United States, every university, had a massive indoor hydroponic house, so that the students who wanted to learn, the students who wanted to have something good to eat, could have that. Maybe that'll happen. And finally, magnesium is vital for brain health. Now, we know that magnesium is good for our bones. Of course it is. And it's good for our heart. It can help prevent a heart attack, about 1,000 milligrams. And it's good for relaxing your muscles. But the newest research from the peer-reviewed journals, especially on Alzheimer's, shows that after the age of 25, our brains begin to shrink. There's structural changes and loss of brain synapses, which leads to rapid decline in cognitive health and also in memory. Quote, the body of our peer-reviewed and published work underscores that magnesium can help maintain healthy brain activity, said one of the scientists. I absolutely agree with that. So let's make sure that we get our magnesium for our brain and our heart and our muscles and our lower back pain. It helps with all that. Next up from our environmental segment. As you know, we are watching everything, including tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, solar storms, every single morning at 4 o'clock when I start looking at all the world's real important news, not the the stuff that were shown on these stupid programs like MSNBC and Fox and the rest, they're such an embarrassment I don't even turn them on anymore. They're so irrelevant. But look what is important. The worst typhoon in world history has just hit the Philippines and on its way now to Vietnam. The question is, shouldn't that make major news? Shouldn't people be discussing why is it the most powerful? Or why did we have over 100,000 unique events or world's hottest, coldest, worst in the last 12 months alone? We're not even acknowledging this. So what's going to happen is we're going to tip in some certain areas. And that's why I've encouraged people to become more self-sufficient, aware, so that you're at least ahead of the problems. This is the latest from Stephen Lehay from Interpress Services. Quote, if global carbon emissions continue to rise at their current rate, humanity will eventually be left with no other option than a costly world war-like mobilization. Quote, it's blindingly obvious that our economic system is failing us. That's according to Professor of Sustainable Development, University of Surrey in the UK, Tim Jackson. Quote, prosperity isn't just about having more stuff. Prosperity is the art of living well on a finite planet. So what this means is this. Climate change, pollution, damaged ecosystems, record species extinction, unsustainable resource use are all clear symptoms of a dysfunctional economic system. And that means for those of us who are choosing to get off the grids wherever possible and to become more self-sufficient. Simple things like joining collectives and food co-ops and going to farmers' markets, supporting local agriculture. Don't buy something you don't need. Recycle, reuse, redesign what you have. Look at the future as the we. You know, the we, if we have a way of helping others who may not have the resources we have, I believe we have a moral responsibility, honoring our spiritual selves, to share in that. And finding the right people to help with different projects. Because now we have the attitude. We know we have to do something. So work together. There are thousands upon thousands of shared living experience environments around the world. I visited them. And so get off the grid. Because for the people who don't care about this, think it's not important to them, think their wealth, their power, their current standard of living, they could walk down a street and they see nothing but bliss, they will be also affected. There's some things that will not affect them, but there's some things, if it's natural, that will. They're just as susceptible to tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, a nuclear disaster, a solar storm, flooding, as anyone else. So that's my suggestion. I also have been mentioning that I'm seeing everywhere a rise in crime, and it's going to get worse. And therefore, I'm suggesting that if those of you who live in urban areas or in especially in suburban areas where historically you move from the city to the cul-de-sacs and suburbia because you want to give a better quality of life to yourself and your family, understand. But now, because of the enormous amount of homes that have been foreclosed on, over 45 million Americans have lost their homes. This is never discussed. I've been filming this for 7 years. I'm going into post-production starting next week on Poverty, Inc., which will be approximately a 52-part series. I film so much everywhere that it's not enough. I can't put it all in one film. It just wouldn't fit. And so I'm doing it as a whole series, and I'll screen it over the internet when it's all ready. In any case, now you're seeing families that would never have thought of committing any crime, committing crimes, and especially the youth. And it's going to get a lot worse. I predict that there'll be a 300% increase in gang activity and membership in the next 2 years. And that's before the correction in stock market. I'm going to go on the record today and state unequivocally that I believe in the next 12 months, this huge, completely fraudulent bubble called Wall Street and bonds and are going to take a hit, anywhere from 20 to 40% devaluation in these, because they're all based upon $90 billion a month being given by the Federal Reserve so the Treasury can continue to issue debt and have someone buy that debt, which is the Federal Reserve. And then all it does is create a fiat currency that floods the market with worthless paper that we'll never be able to pay back. We're virtually insolvent and have been for some time. Well, someday in the near future, next 12 to 24 months, I believe, the U.S. dollar will no longer be the reserve currency. When that happens, then watch what happens to the quality of our life in the United States and the value of things and what it costs to do anything. That's why I'm asking people, get out of debt. Stop buying stuff. Save. But then at the same time, you're going to have people at that point really get into theft. Quote from Michael Snyder, Economic Collapse blog, Tide, that's the laundry detergent, thefts, cargo hijacking, and cattle rustling. Why is an epidemic of thievery sweeping America? I'll just do one paragraph here. Desperate people do desperate things, and it appears that Americans are rapidly becoming a lot more desperate. An epidemic of thievery is sweeping across America, and authorities are not quite sure what to make of it. Down in Texas, cattle thieves can get up to $1,500 per head of cattle, and cattle rustling was nearly 40% up last year. And cargo hijacking is becoming much more sophisticated, and it's being estimated that losses of cargo were $216 million a year. And for some reason, Tide laundry detergent has become a very hot commodity among common criminals across the country. In fact, it's being reported that some grocery stores are losing $10,000 to $15,000 a month as a result of Tide thefts. So why is all this happening? Well, crime is on the rise in the United States, and poverty is absolutely exploding. In fact, according to the latest numbers, the U.S. Census Bureau, 49.2% of all Americans are receiving benefits from at least one governmental program each month. Over the past 5 years, we have seen an unprecedented rise in the number of people that cannot take care of themselves without help from the government. Millions upon millions of Americans that have been forced into poverty are becoming increasingly angry, frustrated, and desperate. And what we are watching right now is only just the beginning. All this is going to get a whole lot worse. When people think of social decay that is happening in America, most of the time, Texas and Oklahoma would not be the first places that come to mind. But according to NPR, that's where 40% of this rise in theft of cows and horses down there is occurring. And by the way, it's happening all over the place. And the reason that they're also stealing Tide, it turns out, from this article, is because they sell it for drugs, or exchange it for drugs, if they don't have cash. What can we do to reverse this? I'm doing a whole three-hour special on this. By the way, I have a five-hour special on the Kennedy assassination with people you have not heard from, giving you actual new insights, all fresh, new, vital information on the Kennedy assassination, five-part series coming up. The Veterans Administration stopped releasing data on injured vets as total reaches a milestone. You have not heard this before. This is from Jamie Reese of International Business Times. Quote, the United States has likely reached a grim but historic milestone in the war on terror. 1 million veterans, these are American veterans, injured from the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you haven't heard this reported anywhere else. Why? Because the government is no longer sharing this information with the public. All that can be said with any certainty is that as of this last December, more than 900,000 servicemen and women have been treated at Department of Veterans Affairs hospitals and clinics since returning from war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that the monthly rate of new patients to these facilities as of the end of 2012 was around 10,000 a month. In any case, I want to thank Doug Rocky for the Sunday night program that precedes mine, the talkback hour I do on Sunday night at 7, because he, more than any other radio program in America, is documenting this and it has an outreach. Here's what I'd like to do. Up on the website and my YouTube, I have a multi-award-winning documentary from this year called American Veterans, Forgotten and Betrayed. Share it with people, especially if you know veterans, because it shows some of the things they can do. it shows that they're not alone, and it shows people who are being challenged for allowing this to happen. I believe that we must do something a lot more to help our veterans, because we only hear about the ones that are seriously injured, the 45,000 who are really terribly injured. We don't hear about all the others that are suffering from psychological problems, post-traumatic stress disorder, suicidal tendencies, and Gulf War syndrome. Now you're up to a million injuries. And yet they're denied completely, and they shouldn't be. Be against the wars, absolutely I am, but don't be against people who are suffering. And that's important. Our talkback segment that we'll keep the last few minutes of the program open for, here's what I'm going to ask you now. This is from Leslie Uphold. Quote, there are 16.4 million American children living in dire poverty. That's nearly one quarter, 22.6% of all of our children. More alarming is that the percentage of poor children has climbed since the start of the Great Recession in 2007. And poor means poor. For a family of three with one child under 18, the poverty line is 18,000. Meanwhile, the stock market is booming. Banks, hedge funds, and private equity firms are making tens of billions of dollars again, while the luxury housing and goods market has skyrocketed. Most amazing of all is the fact that 95% of the so-called recovery has gone to the top 1%, who have seen their incomes rise by 34%. And for the 99%, there's been an undeclared wage freeze. The average wage has climbed only 0.4%. And to add to the misery, Washington decided that the best way to tackle childhood poverty is to have poor kids eat less. And it's both Democrats and Republicans who are responsible for this. How would you deal with this? This is my question on TalkBack today. We have 18 million kids that don't have enough to eat each day. Now, if you add in all the kids whose family is at the poverty level, not dire poverty, but actual poverty, it's over 50% of all children and over one half of all Americans. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. If you'd like to address with your input on this phenomena that we have hundreds of billions to spend on national defense, on spying on people, on wars, on maintaining pork for politicians and their pet projects, on inefficiency of in bureaucracies, but we don't have money to feed our children. What do you do about it? Why aren't we talking about this? Why isn't this a major issue anywhere? I'd like to hear from you. I'm Gary Nall. We're about to talk about children, but I think it's time we also took an honest look at what has happened in the United States. I'm a big believer that if we're going to have any law, and I believe that probably 80% of all laws should be reviewed because most of them are antiquated, archaic, and but yet they're still in the books. That means if someone wants to charge you with something, they can. I'm also against all security violations where individuals' phones, emails, or any communication between individuals are read and captured by the government. They have no right to that. It's none of their business. Then why would they be doing this? Why would they know that 99.999% of the American population have never, nor ever would, engage in any terrorist activity? I believe it's because of blackmail. Because what has come out now is that they're collecting this information, and therefore, if your name ever comes up, they can go through every phone call you've ever made, every picture you've ever sent, everything that you've ever said, and they can create a negative profile, and they could use it against you. They shouldn't have that right. They shouldn't have that power. And we shouldn't allow a government to lord over us in this way. It's dangerous. And yet, we're told that we're a country of laws. I disagree. We're a country of hypocrisy. Dean Acheson declared 51 years ago that power, position, and prestige are the ingredients of national security, and that national security trumps law. In the United States, democracy takes a back seat to national security, a prerogative of the executive branch of government. National security is where the executive branch hides its crimes against law, both domestic and international, its crimes against the Constitution, its crimes against innocent civilians, both at home and abroad, and its secret agendas that it knows that the American public would never support. National security, in my opinion, is the cloak that the executive branch uses to make certain that the U.S. government is unaccountable. Without accountable government, there is no civil liberty and no democracy except for the sham voting that extends throughout the United States. There have been periods in U.S. history, such as President Lincoln's war to prevent secession, World War I, World War II, when accountable government was impaired. These were short episodes of the Constitution's violation, and the Constitution was reinstated in the aftermath of the wars. However, since Bill Clinton and his gang, a bright and best college grads, went to government with no accountability of government, it has been in steep decline. Americans have not defended their rights to convey the U.S. Constitution for the duration of the terms of these presidents. We never gave it to them. Said, here, take the Constitution, Bill of Rights. Do with it what you want. The Clinton regime was not held accountable for its illegal attack on Serbia. The Bush regime was not held accountable for its illegal invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. The Obama regime was not held accountable for its renewable attack on Afghanistan and its illegal attacks on Libya, Pakistan, and Yemen, or its proxy war in Syria. We have also had other strictly illegal and unconstitutional acts of government for which the government has not been held accountable. The Bush regime's acts of torture, indefinite detention, warrantless spying, and the Obama regime's act of indefinite detention, warrantless spying, and murder of U.S. citizens without due process. As the Obama regime lies through its teeth, that's all it ever does is lie, constantly. I don't know if it's capable or he's capable of actually making any honest statement. We sit quietly. If these numerous criminal acts of U.S. government spread over the terms of three presidents and they pass into history as unchallenged events, except for those progressive voices that do speak the truth, the government will have acquired squatters' rights and lawlessness. U.S. Constitution will be, as George W. Bush is reported to have declared, a scrap of paper. Lawlessness is the hallmark of tyranny enforced by the police state. In a police state, law is not a protector of rights, but a weapon in the hands of government. The accused has no recourse to the accusation, which does not require evidence presented to a court. The accused is guilty by accusation alone and can be shot in the back of the head, as under Stalin, or Mao Zedong, or Hitler, or just blown up by a drone missile under Obama. As a person aware of the long struggle against the tyrannical state, I'm amazed and disheartened by the acceptance, not only by the American public, but also by the law schools, the bar associations, the media, Congress, and the Supreme Court of the executive branch's claim to be above the law and the U.S. Constitution. Liberals and conservatives chasing after their favorite devils, and prosecutors, judges, and police devoted to conviction and not to justice. We don't have justice in our justice system. It's a mockery. And these have gradually eroded over time the concept of law as a protection of the innocent. With the atmosphere that created 9/11, the final destruction of the protective features of law was quickly achieved in the name of making us safe from terrorism. Yes? No. The fact that we are no longer safe from our own government didn't seem to register. This is how liberty was lost, and with it, America. From Paul Craig Roberts, I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so.
I'd like to welcome you. I'm Gary Noll. I came across something that's really, really neat. We were cleaning out a storage locker, and there were these cases that said Gary's lectures, and these were old VHS tapes, and there were 76 lectures that I've done that I forgot about them. I've never offered them. They're there, so I put one in. I started watching. I thought, this is neat. Some of them's dated, but I'm going to look for an intern to come in They can come in the day or the evenings, doesn't matter, weekends, and watch these and make notes on them, because I'm going to get these in shape. They're not broadcast quality on television. They're not in high def, but the messages are sure good. So if you'd like to intern, volunteer to help do this, call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and you can come in anytime you want, and because someone's always here. All right. Let's say hello to my guest who is standing by. She is Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, board-certified nephrologist and an internist. Nice to have you with us.
Hello, Gary. Thank you for having me on.
This week I've been discussing in depth the information on what we really never pay attention to, the real underlying causes of disease that lead to epidemics, and that the important ones were never dealt with because of a vaccine. It was the child labor, when kids would go to work at 4, 5, and 6 years of age, working 14 hours a day in the coal mines and other mines in the mills. It was the garbage that was everywhere. It was the fact no one had running water in their homes and had no public sanitation. It was putting a dead body just out on the street. It was drinking water. It was coming right from where all the human waste and animal excrement was going. When these were cleaned up, and only when they were cleaned up, and where they were cleaned up, you saw a radical reversal of public health diseases. And yet, historically, it was the vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, which, by the way, was never made from smallpox. It was the measles vaccine, and it was the polio vaccine. All these are lies. Would you take a few moments, please, and explain, based upon your work and the outstanding a work of Roman Bistrenik and your Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccine, and the Forgotten History, about the truth of how we've been lied to by all of our pharmacists, nurses, doctors, administrators, the media, on this issue of what caused the disease and what actually overcame them. The forum is yours.
Sure. Well, you know, we hear a lot about vaccines being safe and effective, and that's really only part of the story. And I think you've done a pretty good job, Gary, of really demonstrating that vaccines are not safe and effective. But there's another element, which is, are vaccines even necessary? And to Roman and myself, that was a big question that we had and that we looked into when we were writing this book. And I think we have given a pretty good answer to that. And we've also put in 50 graphs that display what really happened and the timing of the events of these disease epidemics and pandemics and the timing of the vaccines. So as you're saying, there was child labor, there was abhorrent living conditions, very similar to what we're seeing in India today. And, you know, whenever there's war, like we're seeing in Syria, now we're seeing polio, and that should be no surprise to anybody. You know, when Russia broke down before it turned into, when USSR broke down before it turned into Russia, we saw another reverse attenuation experiment go bad, when we saw diphtheria had gone down when they had food and nutrition, and then we saw diphtheria levels go up despite their incredibly high vaccination levels. So when you look at the mortality rates for the major infectious diseases, and there were 11 of them, which we discuss in the book, and from the mid-1700s onwards, you'll see a trend. But where we really got the most data was from the mid-1800s through today. And what you'll see is a cascading decline of over 99%, for example, with measles in mortality before the vaccine even came onto the scene. And, you know, there was once upon a time when peasants were able to live in the land and cultivate their own food and have their own animals. And during those periods, there was some disease, but there was never the devastating epidemics that started to occur around mid-1700s through to the 1800s. And, for example, in England, there was the Land Enclosure Act, which took those peasants out of the land and drove them into the city to take part, essentially, in the Industrial Revolution. And in the United States, we saw a similar occurrence, although it wasn't, I don't think there was the same legal land enclosure acts, but we saw droves of people coming into cities that were ill-prepared for them. And during that time, people were consuming rotten meat made into sausages filled with sawdust. That's just one example. The pigs, thank goodness for the pigs, actually. The pigs were running free in the streets eating the garbage, and if the pigs weren't doing that, it probably would have been much worse. But, you know, there were dead animal carcasses. Human waste was thrown out the windows into lobby alleyways, and then the top of that was skimmed off as the drinking water. Children were working as young as they could perform any sort of function. There were no child labor laws. Puerperal fever was really a hot fire burning at that period, and that was because doctors were refusing to wash their hands after going to the morgue, despite the fact that Semmelweis, the Austrian physician, was telling them that if they just only washed their hands before attending deliveries, that these women that were dying at a rate between 15% and 30% in all parts of the world that were moving away from midwifery and into male midwives, obstetricians, these women were dying. And so what happens when these women die? And this was a big impact, actually, that I wrote a section of in the book, because people don't realize this, is that when a mother dies, her infant is four times more likely to die. So you had a high infant mortality rate from that. And women at that point took up, childbearing women, remember, there was no birth control then. They took up a large portion of the population. They were having numerous children, so their chances of dying were rather high. So then a mother dies, and what's left after that? We have a father who's stressed out, and we have an infant, and we have other children usually. So what are we going to do with those children? Well, we're going to put them to work. So that also fed into the system that was taking children and working their fingers to the bones. And while today, you know, we can talk about how terrible our school systems are and our nutritional programs are, they were nothing like what they were in these countries during this period of time. And so when we started to see social programs and we started to see sanitations and plumbers come in and fresh water being pumped in and isolation of cases that were sick is when we started to see huge declines in mortality from these infectious diseases. And while we didn't see the infectious diseases necessarily all go away, we did see some of them go away. We did see cholera go in the United States without ever having a vaccine. We did see tuberculosis go away in the United States without having a vaccine. Scarlet fever is a toxin-mediated disease that actually lives in a bacteria, and so we still have that bacteria. I still see cases of scarlet fever, but they're not killing people, and they're not causing the degree of damage that they did then, because vitamin C is key. And as are other nutritional factors in fueling the mitochondria to fighting off the toxin of scarlet fever. So it was all about nutrition and sanitation and social programs and getting children to sleep and putting them in better situations, and not the vaccines, not the antibiotics, not surgeons. The total contribution of healthcare to the decline in the mortality of these 11 infectious diseases was approximately 3.5%.
3.5.
We have a graph in the book that
96.5% came from public improvement in food, roads that would bring fresh produce in, cleaning up the hospitals, cleaning up the water. Cleaning up the water was one of the most important things. Cleaning up the milk supply was also important. Food standards, getting rid of child labor, all these things. Having zoning so that you wouldn't have a heavy-duty industry with pollutants going right into the air. All this is contributing, and yet none of this was credited. So that's what I'm sure at some point you must have found rather challenging, that your medical compatriots would not look at the same information that you had available and come to some similar decision. Why are we giving all this credit to a vaccine when it's all these other things that cause the reduction and decline of these diseases?
That's right. Well, I had two shocks, because my first shock was when I first realized it myself. Because remember, I came through this system. I was once a member, a full functioning card carrying member of this system, a full believer. You know, I thought vaccines were a necessary evil until I started seeing that necessary evil causing overt kidney failure in my patients. And I started seeing people dying afterwards. And I started questioning, and I was told, well, smallpox, polio is eradicated in this country thanks to a vaccine. What's your problem, Dr. Humphreys? Vaccines are safe and effective. Influenza vaccines need to be given to people who are having heart attacks on their first day of admission, who are septic, who have pneumonia. You name it. You come in, if you can sign a consent form and talk to a pharmacist who's giving you advice, you get two vaccines as an adult on your first day of admission. So I started investigating that on my own, and lo and behold, turned up all kinds of information, not fringe, you know, radical sources. This was in our own medical textbooks from the past 150 to 200 years, and still is in there today. I mean, there is so much information today as to the harm that's caused by the components of vaccines. If you just look at aluminum, you know, it's not that there's not enough science to prove that aluminum is hazardous and dangerous to be injecting into any human being, let alone a one-day-old infant. There's too much information. I have trouble distilling it down to convey it to other doctors. And when I do, they still don't believe it because they can't. It's like a cognitive dissonance that they can't understand how the system could be doing something that's so counter to health and that they've actually been a participant in it. And most doctors have a big problem with that.
I thank you for your good work on this subject, and let us hope that in time more people will pay attention to this. And we've had, by the way, over 1.6 million people watch the silent epidemic, which you're in. And it's spreading. How many people beyond that have shared it with other people? We don't know. And I could only imagine that it's up probably 2 to 3 times that amount. So word's getting out.
And it is. And it was great that you did that film with all those other physicians and scientists. It was just really great that it was done. And we're so grateful to you for doing that.
And by the way, there was a whole panel afterwards, so of which Dr. Humphreys was a member. And if any of you want to go to Gary Knoll on YouTube, watch the full film, The Silent Epidemic, then watch the panel discussion afterwards, and you'll get some incredibly important insights. Because the questions that need to be asked were, and the evidence from all these leading MD, PhDs, who had no biases, they were just telling us the truth, would completely overturn our entire understanding of vaccines. Thanks a lot, Susanna.
Okay, thank you, Gary. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye. And that's why we do this. It's a public health issue to empower people. And let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from Robert from Vancouver. You've got your Canadian group, eh?
Yes.
He says he once attended a lecture that you did in Vancouver. He's a long-time listener. And he said it was such a packed house that you ended up having to do 3 back-to-back lectures. And he ended up being in the last one. And he said, boy, it was so worth the wait. And he asked, when are you coming back to Vancouver?
Probably sometime in the next 6 months. I'm going to take 3 months just to go home and relax and garden, be with the animals, and write. And also I'm going to be working on my sequel cookbook. This one is, I think this week we had 3 different bestsellers. That's what I was told. The one on arthritis and pain, one on the cookbook, and one on joy juicing. So I'm going to do a sequel, and I love creating. So all day long I'm going to create. Then I've told people no more lectures until then. I'm going to do one in New York. Then I'm going to go out. And I haven't been up to Canada. I haven't been in Toronto and Montreal and places for a while, so I will go there. I'm asking the agencies and the different people that asked me to come in and lecture, let's go up to Canada. I'm also going to England and Ireland and Scotland, and I'm going to do a world lecture tour. I haven't done that for a while. And so it's coming, but not until the spring and summer. That's when I'm going to take the message out around the world, because I've got 4 documentaries right now finished, sitting, waiting for release over the next 14 months, and 4 new books waiting, finished, not released yet, not discussed yet. So I've got ahead of the curve. Now I can go out there and show this. And then we'll get into other issues on our next program. I thank you all very much for listening. I'm Gary Knoll.